Wisconsin has 827 registered fire departments. That's according to the State Department of Safety and Professional Services. Of those, three-quarters are volunteer. Wisconsin is updating training standards and making a rule change impacting hundreds of fire departments across the state. We're talking about it on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. To look more at this rule revision, let's bring in Danielle Kading. She is WPR's reporter in Superior and the host of the regional program Hear Me Out. Danny, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, no problem, Kate.
So Wisconsin depends on volunteer fire departments. What are these new state training requirements and how are they different from the current standards?
So basically, the new requirements, they have been changed to comply with neighboring states and federal requirements set by OSHA, the government's worker safety arm. In the past, there was a two-year grace period for new firefighters to meet minimum standards for training. And now that's been removed. And so basically, any firefighter has to have that training before they head into any dangerous situations.
And what is the timeline for this? When will it take effect?
So that part of the rule takes effect this coming October. Other parts of the rule have already been in effect since last October. The thinking behind that, my understanding is that by putting out that date to reach the new minimum standards, it would give firefighters time to get that training necessary in order to comply with the new rule.
Do you think, have you heard departments have enough time to adapt to this, fully adapt to this new rule?
Yeah, like I said, I think that's the idea behind putting out that date for compliance to this fall. It just gives them another year to get that training that they need in order to meet these new training requirements.
Help us understand the difference between a public and private fire department.
So public fire departments are ones that are, you know, operated by a municipality or serve a municipality. Private departments would be those hired by a company. Like, for example, Husky Energy in Superior has its own fire department. So the standards are different already for private fire departments. They already have to meet these minimum standards by OSHA in order to have training before they head into any dangerous situation. Wisconsin hasn't had to do that. Their public firefighters haven't had to do that.
And there are new requirements for fire officers as well. What is the job of fire officers?
So fire officers have a higher level of training and they're certified in most cases. And so they have to get extra training as part of that. So the grace period of 1 year for them to get that more comprehensive training has been removed. But fire officers that were in place prior to this rule taking, parts of this rule taking effect last year, will be grandfathered in. So only new fire officers after October of last year will have to get that training right away.
We're talking with Danielle Kading. She's WPR's reporter in Superior, talking about an update to a state rule known as SPS 330 that will bring new minimum standards for firefighter training in Wisconsin, potentially putting a staffing crunch on departments. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a member of a volunteer fire department? How are these training standards impacting you? Let's hear about it. 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Danny, how do Wisconsin's current firefighting regulations compare to other states and national rules?
Well, right now, Wisconsin is the only state in the region that doesn't currently comply with the OSHA standards. Neighboring states like Minnesota and Illinois and Michigan and Iowa, they all incorporate these federal requirements. And as far as nationally, that's a little bit more difficult to gauge. But Nate Melby, the president of the Wisconsin State Fire Chiefs Association, thinks Wisconsin is probably among states in the nation with the lowest training standards.
And 80% of Wisconsin's fire departments are volunteer fire departments. How will the new state requirement impact those departments?
So volunteer departments are saying that they're a little bit concerned about this rule change. It gives them less time, they feel, to comply with these new standards. They were happy with the grace period before because a lot of times their volunteers are working day jobs for 40 hours a week and they have families and other commitments, and this was more flexible for them in order to meet those standards to be on their department. Now there's some fear that with this change that might have a chilling effect on recruiting or keeping members.
Have we seen any impact of that yet, or is it too soon?
You know, I think volunteer fire departments are already struggling around the state, so it's hard to separate any changes to this rule from the challenges that they're already seeing. You know, because people are working more, it's harder for them to find volunteers in rural areas, and a lot of the volunteers in rural areas are starting to age out. So I think recruitment and retention is just a challenge in general, and this is kind of just adding to the stress that they might be feeling.
And how close in proximity would new training opportunities be? Would these volunteer firefighters have to travel great distances to get the training that is required?
Well, that's what some volunteer fire chiefs are saying, is that, you know, in order to get this training, they would have to go to a technical college, which might be an hour or an hour and a half away. And that puts some stress on those volunteers to be able to attend those courses. But under the rule change, it says that they can receive, new members can receive this training and education from any qualified instructor. So that doesn't necessarily mean that they have to get training from a technical college. It just means that they have to get training from someone who has the proper materials to help them become a new member, and that's been approved and complies with the OSHA standards.
How have departments generally responded to the update? Do you feel like they had a sense there was a safety gap?
I think career firefighters are more likely to support this change than volunteer firefighters, but, you know, the Wisconsin State Fire Chiefs Association did a survey of its members. They have around 1,100 members in the state, and they got 101 responses back. And the majority of those said that they support this change. And so I think, you know, all firefighters in the state, whether they're volunteer or paid, think that it's a good idea to be as safe as possible and have training in place for their members. The thing that you're hearing from some volunteer fire chiefs is that it's a good idea, but in practice, it can be difficult to achieve.
Well, Danny, thank you so much for bringing us up to speed. We appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem, Kate.
Danielle Kading is WPR's reporter. She's based in Superior, and she's been explaining a new state rule that will go into effect later this year. It's meant to bring up training standards at departments around the state. You can join in this conversation, 800-642-1234. Are you a firefighter? How will you be impacted by this new state rule? Are you on a volunteer department? How did you get into it, and will you be able to meet the new requirements? Call in. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Call in at 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation with a focus on what's involved in training requirements. That's coming up on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The most recent needs assessment put together by the National Fire Protection Association in 2015 found 36% of Wisconsin departments had firefighters who had not been formally trained in fighting structure fires, which is more complex than content fires. We'll be breaking that down, that jargon down, what a new state rule will do in increasing the amount of training that firefighters must have. Romana Greschel is a fire instructor at Gateway Technical College, which oversees state-sanctioned fire and EMS training in Racine, Kenosha, and Walworth counties. She started her career as a volunteer firefighter in Wheatland. Romana, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
So you've been training firefighters at Gateway Technical College for a couple years now. What does this training look like?
So the basic fundamentals start at Firefighter 1, and what they learn there is anywhere from hose movement to, you know, fire suppression needs, how to raise and lift a ladder. They're learning just a small touch of what is actually needed for structural firefighting. It's a 96-hour course, at least for down by us and at Gateway Technical College. It does change a little bit when you get up further up north with those technical college requirements, but down by us, we give a 96-hour course, which provides a lot of those fundamentals. And most firefighters, at least from the volunteer standpoint, do actually stop there at the Firefighter 1 certification level, and that is, again, just a small certification out of all the ones that are offered by the state.
So 96 hours of training for that initial training, that's right?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. So help us understand, we learn in that training about structural fires. What is the difference between structural fires and content fires?
So structural fires, you're dealing with the building itself. So you have a content fire, you know, you have something that maybe was outside burning. It's a little bit different. You get to structural, you're dealing with anything from, look at these, the residential homes that we have. You've got brick, you've got concrete, you've got wood. Those can pose a huge risk to the firefighters when we're fighting the fire. So you put water on that fire, now you've got a water load that is on top of that building, or those floors, and if there's firefighters in that building, that's where, if they're not educated in knowledge of building construction, that's where it could end up costing their life if they're not fully trained in what they're doing.
So there could be a lot of engineering to understand, too, of the load of a building and the stress of water on the actual structure of that building.
Very much so.
So how will the new state requirements keep firefighters safe?
So the new state requirements are requiring the firefighters, at least from the entry level, to complete those 96 hours and then have the certification to be able to go into the buildings and actually perform fire suppression needs with, you know, having an SCBA on and keeping themselves safe. When you look at it from the changes that came from the officer role, the officer role is really, really important when it comes to the firefighting in general, whether it's structural firefighting or you're on scene at a car accident, or even we're definitely tied in. It's not just firefighters, but we're tied in with EMS services as well. And it's keeping everybody safe. You have somebody trained to a level where they're not only looking after themselves, but they're looking after the others that are on that scene. So they're kind of watching out for mainly a lot of safety issues. They're kind of making sure that everybody's in the right places at the right time. And so if the person sitting in that seat, which usually we call the officer seat, is the passenger seat of the front of the vehicle, if they're not properly trained and sitting in that seat, that could cost not only their own lives, but everybody else's lives on that scene, and God forbid anybody else, that, including the public. There's a lot of training in terms of the do's and don'ts of what is safe and what's not, looking out for, again, the safety aspect in holding that officer role, executing the fire operation, making sure that if there's any changes, I mean, you get wind in there, you get anything, fire changes very, very rapidly. So if the officers are not trained in watching out for that, it could definitely cost everybody injury and most definitely life.
So the officer sitting in that seat, in that passenger side of the truck, is really calling the shots on what is happening in the fire and who is doing what and what is the next step for a fire?
Yes.
So besides safety, why is it important for firefighters to keep training throughout their careers?
If you look at the world we live in, you know, especially the technology, I'll use the building construction for one thing. Building construction now and what it was like, say, 30 years ago is completely different. Buildings are being built with lightweight construction, truss construction, and it may be an easier way to build buildings. But when it comes to firefighting, that's really concerning on our behalf because these buildings are burning quicker and faster. So before, when you used to have a little bit more time to either get to the fire to save the building, it's coming to the fact that these combustible materials are burning faster and quicker, and it's not only putting the people living in the house at risk even more, it's putting us at risk. So before, when we used to go on top of a roof to ventilate and help some of those gases escape out of the building to help with our fire suppression needs, now it's getting to the point where by the time we get there, it's not safe enough for us to get up on there.
So it sounds like materials haven't become more safe, the building materials that are going up in new construction, which is surprising because we have such a focus on safety in our building codes.
Yes, that's definitely changing with the building codes as well. We just live in a world where everything changes so quick. So even if our job is changing all the time, it's, again, things that we don't have control over, firefighters that are affecting our job. I always use it a comparison with when I've most recently tried to explain this to people. You have a hairdresser. Hairdresser has been cutting hair for 30 years, started cutting her hair, cutting people's hair in the 80s where, you know, perms were a popular thing. If you get to the hairdresser that hasn't really kept up on her continuing education or the trends of what's going on, she's still going to be giving that same haircut now these days when obviously those aren't really necessarily the fashion anymore. In comparison with that, there's definitely trends and ways that we do things as firefighters that are very, very vastly different from when we did 30 years ago. So that's where continuing education as firefighters is very important to not only the health and safety, but in many ways than not, keeping the public safe as well.
Ramona Greschel is with us, a fire instructor at Gateway Technical College, overseeing state-sanctioned fire and EMS training in Racine, Kenosha, and Walworth counties. Ramona, when you look at this training and the new updates to training, what do you see the state moving toward as it becomes in compliance with OSHA standards?
I think they're definitely moving in a positive direction. I know that there's a lot of volunteer departments and members that I've talked to, and they're very concerned over this. But I do also have a handful that I've talked to as well that are like, hey, this is a step in the right direction. This is going to be, you know, a definite safety issue on our behalf that's going to keep us all safe. I grew up in southeastern Wisconsin in Wheatland. I started at that department when I was 17 years old. The training that I received down at that department, it was good. It was just a touch, though, of what I've learned. And then when I moved on in my career, I realized how much that I didn't know. And so that's where I want to be an advocate for the fire service and an advocate for those volunteer departments to let them know that, hey, you know, we can do this. As a technical college, we can help you get there. The new rules that came in with the changes for the fire officer and for the driver operator standards, at least with the fire officer ones, we can help out with all of them, all the changes that are happening with the SPS 330. But we can get them to where they need to be without them actually having to create time to be there for these extra classes. So we want to put their minds at ease that this is going to be a positive change that will get them to where they need to get to, and they shouldn't worry as much as they are right now.
How is firefighting doing as an industry? Are there enough people to fill the state's needs?
No, actually, we're having a huge struggle. For the past 10 years, there's been a huge decline, and we're not exactly 100% sure on where to pinpoint that. But we're struggling on all levels, on the volunteer levels, the paid on call. Even the full-time departments are struggling in finding firefighters that are meeting their needs. again, we're not sure if it's just other jobs are out there, if it's the safety issue, if it's a generation issue. Not exactly sure where that problem is coming from. Definitely trying to turn that around, but it's not just in Wisconsin. It's a national problem and most likely an international problem as well.
And before we let you go, how are tech schools like Gateway able to help departments meet their requirements?
So anywhere between if the volunteer departments, you know, if the individual wants to go to the Gateway website or any other surrounding technical college, they can sign up individually for that class. Or if, and at least for the departments in our district for Gateway, if they want to call us specifically and have us come out, we've had anywhere, like, let's just use Randall, Twin Lakes, and Wheatland. We've done classes before where they'll put the three departments together. One of the departments will host it, and then we'll come out actually to them and host it in their at their firehouse. So
meeting them where they are. Yeah. Ramana, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Ramana Greschel is a fire instructor at Gateway Technical College, overseeing state-sanctioned fire and EMS training in Racine, Kenosha, and Walworth counties. She started her career as a volunteer firefighter in Wheatland. Coming up next, the government shutdown on its 24th day has wide-ranging effects. We talk with a member of the Oneida Nation, and a news update is next. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. During this partial government shutdown, Native American tribes are not receiving funds, especially in the critical area of health services. The Department of the Interior runs the Bureaus of Indian Affairs and Indian Education, and it is shut down. Over half of its 4,000 employees are currently on furlough. We're talking about the shutdown's impact on Native communities here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Candace Skinnador is with us. She is the self-governance coordinator for the Oneida Nation of Wisconsin. That's a federally recognized tribe of Oneida people with a reservation located in parts of two counties near Green Bay. Candace, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
So why would this federal government shutdown impact Native American tribes in the first place? Can you explain how funding of some services within tribes works?
Absolutely. So the Oneida Nation is considered a self-governance tribe. And self-governance is it's something that passed by Congress back in 1975 through the Indian Self-Determination and Education Assistance Act. And what it does is programs, services, functions, and activities that the federal government is responsible providing to Native Americans and to Indian tribes because of the lands that were ceded to the federal government by the tribes through treaties, allows Native Americans to kind of take that responsibility over from those programs and services from the federal government, so the tribes can reprogram those services to better meet the needs of their communities. It made sense to have tribes self-govern because they know what their community needs better than somebody that is out in Washington, D.C. So because of those treaties and the trust obligations that the federal government has with Native Americans, they help fund those programs and services that the tribes have taken over.
Help us understand what services we're talking about.
Okay, so we have a federal compact and a funding agreement with both the Department of Interior and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. So under the Health and Human Services side, we provide health care. So we have a health clinic. Such services are like preventative health, medical, behavioral health, stuff like that. And then on the BIA side, we took over about 20 programs from there. That ranges from environmental to education to Indian child welfare, social services, road maintenance, parks, stuff like that.
What is your sense of how tribes feel about the government allowing payment to lapse for these services?
Well, tribes are impacted greatly, and I was just on a phone call with Indian Health Service late last week, and some of the tribes, especially in the Great Plains area, have already stated that if they didn't receive funding by Friday, that their health clinic they're going to shut down, and that some emergency services such as ambulance is going to be shut down that week. So this is going to be the start of that week where those tribes have indicated they're already having the shutdown services or to scale back on services until funding comes in.
Ambulance service is huge, though. I mean, that's a really extreme measure, is it not?
Oh, absolutely, and especially out in the Great Plain area. If you shut down a health center, the next closest health center might be hundreds of miles away. And if you don't have any way to transport patients to those health centers, it can be life or death.
And this isn't the first time this has happened.
No. I think the most recent history is in 2013 that happened as well, but that one didn't last as long as what we're in right now.
Is there a particular service, you're talking about EMS, ambulance service, are there specific services that Native communities have really intense repercussions from the shutdown?
Well, the beauty about self-governance is that the tribes are allowed to reprogram and redesign programs to meet the needs of their community. So it's basically whatever the tribe prioritizes. We prioritize a lot of our funding for health, so we focus a lot more on health. So what we can do is, we'll say like Indian child welfare is also a very important priority for the Oneida Nation. So we can take funds that we receive for, say, road maintenance that we use for SALT. We can reprogram that funding into the Indian Child Welfare Department if we need to. So it's hard to say one particular program, although I'm assuming that health is probably a consistent priority for many nations or tribal nations.
We're talking with Candace Skinnador. She is self-governance coordinator for the Oneida Nation of Wisconsin. That's a federally recognized tribe of Oneida people with a reservation located in parts of two counties near Green Bay. We're talking about the impact of the partial government shutdown on services. Are you a member of the Oneida Nation or another Native American tribe in Wisconsin or in the Midwest? Have you felt the effects of the shutdown? Do you worry about what might happen if this shutdown continues? We'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How do you think these funding shortfalls could be avoided in the future? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Candace, can you explain a little bit further what Indian Health Service is, and how the shutdown has affected IHS funding?
Yes, so Indian Health Service is actually an agency of the Health and Human Services Department. However, the funding comes from the Department of Interior. So unlike other HHS federal programs, such as the Veterans Affairs and like Medicare and Medicaid, they're not impacted as much as IHS because all their funding comes from the Department of Interior, which is one of the departments that's affected by the shutdown. So the Oneida Nation receives approximately 44% of its operating costs through IHS. So right now we're looking at, like, we're able to operate our health center at full capacity because we're using carryover funding from previous years and from third-party reimbursement. However, if this shutdown continues, we're going to have to start looking at other means to fund that operation. And that might mean scaling back on services, maybe only funding those services that mean life and death. We can look at maybe tapping into other resources. However, there's costs that are associated with those resources, and it's not entirely sure that tribes will be reimbursed for those costs. I know at the last shutdown, they weren't reimbursed. So there's some hard decisions that we need to make depending on how long the shutdown occurs.
How long can your carryover funding stretch? How long can it last, do you think?
It depends. If we're going to operate at full capacity, we're looking around mid-March, maybe early April. If we start scaling back on services and really just helping those that are at the highest priority, we can maybe go until late spring, early summer.
There's also the food distribution program. Can you tell us how this program works?
Yes, so we receive federal funding to help pay for food distribution. We actually had a meeting last week, and we received notice from the Federal Food and Nutrition Service that directed Wisconsin to issue their food share benefit for the month of February on or near January 20th. So this means that people that receive these monthly benefits are going to receive two benefits in January, and they're not going to receive anything in February. So we're working to get the communication out, letting those families know you're not going to receive anything in February. You're going to need to start rationing. And then come March, we're not going to receive any benefits if the shutdown still occurs, and that will affect about 455 households in our community, which means that we're going to have to try to find other ways to feed our families. We do have a food pantry, so we're looking at making a push to increase donations there. We also have other, like a commodity program. However, they only have a three-month supply of food left, and the money that they have is going to run out at the end of February. So if this shutdown occurs, you know, March, April, we're going to have to make some decisions on how we're going to take care of our community.
So the food distribution program is in the same boat as SNAP benefits, which is also in the same predicament, basically.
Absolutely.
So when you were facing a shutdown in the past, in 2013, during the Obama administration, were you able to learn from that and figure out where priorities were?
Yes, we after the 2013, we evaluated the impacts, identified priorities, and we actually created a budget management and control law. And that law requires that each of the departments within the nation develop a budget contingency plan. And the plan basically identifies the strategies and what to do during a financial burden or a financial crisis. And it also allows our business committee to work with our chief financial officer to determine the financial health of the tribe, and then to set like tiers or measures on like a different phase of what we're going into. So I believe next month, if there's still a shutdown, we're going to probably have some meetings and discuss if we're going to start going into cost containment.
So is this the first time you would be putting the budget contingency plans into motion?
Yes.
And so you... You really don't know if they work or whether the priorities are absolutely accurate. It's probably pretty touch and go.
It is, but I know at least for our health clinic, we've already, like, we were able to save some money in case of something like this, so kind of like rainy day fund, and that's what's going to be able to, you know, extend our program and service until, you know, mid-March, maybe, depending if we scale back on services, maybe June or July. So in that aspect, we're better off than we were in 2013 because we were already, like, at that point where we needed to just treat life or death situations, where now we have that rainy day fund that we can tap into. However, we don't know, you know, future shutdowns, you know, we're already depleting our carryover fund, so it's hard to get back to where we were, you know, before that.
Right. So a situation you just don't really know where to go next. There are 11 federally recognized Native American Indian tribes here in Wisconsin. Each
in
has
its
own growing structures and its own resources, and that means each tribal government is dealing with the shutdown differently. You can call in at 800-642-1234. Join us. There are 11 federally recognized Native American Indian tribes here in Wisconsin. Each has its own governing structures and its own level of resources. And that means each tribal government is dealing with this shutdown differently. Tribal nations are taking it one day at a time as the shutdown stretches into its 24th day, now the longest closure in U.S. history. We're talking about the impact on tribal communities here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The United Nations Self-Governance Coordinator, Candace Skinnador, stays with us. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a member of the United Nation or another Native American tribe here in Wisconsin or in the Midwest? Have you felt the impact of the shutdown? In what way do you worry about what might happen if the shutdown continues? We'd like to hear from you. 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Now, Candace, each tribal community, tribal nation, has its own governance, its own resources, basically, and is probably being impacted uniquely by the partial government shutdown based on what it does with those dollars. Is that right?
That's correct, except for not every tribe is a self-governance tribe. Some tribes are a direct service tribe, which means that they haven't taken that responsibility over to provide those programs, that the federal government is still providing those programs. But with the government shut down, it's not only a financial burden, but it's also an operational burden, because a lot of tribes work closely with the federal partners to provide these programs. Either it's waiting for approval for, you know, referring a patient out to receive health care, or it's, you know, relying on federal grants. And because those staff are furloughed, they're not there to answer those questions, to do the reviews, or to give approvals. So a lot of the projects that we may be working on or considering working on might be halted until the shutdown is lifted, because they need to work with those federal partners to get that stuff done.
Are tribal governments talking to one another right now and exchanging ideas on how to get through this?
Absolutely. And I'll give props to Indian Health Service. They have a weekly call every Thursday where all the tribes or any tribe can call in, and they provide an update and they answer questions. On the BIA side, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, we haven't heard any communication from them at all. But I know that some tribal organizations, such as the National Indian Health Board, have been providing phone calls and updates. The tribal self-governance advisory committees have been sending out information to tribes, letting them know. They're also soliciting impacts from tribes, because there's a push on the national level to change the way that Indian Health Service and the BIA is funded, so that if future shutdowns occur, there's a way to prevent, you know, tribes from feeling those impacts.
Why do you think you haven't heard from Indian Affairs?
Well, they're kind of notorious for poor communication. I don't know. I tried emailing some of my contacts. I just get an email kickback saying that they're out of the office until the furlough is lifted. I know that there are some, like, higher up staff that are there, but they really haven't had direction on what to do. They have a plan in place that's posted on their website, but I believe that's a couple years old already. And I know that the Secretary of Interior just left his post late last year, early this year, and so there's a vacancy there, so maybe it's just a lack of leadership right now.
And help us understand what Indian Affairs governs, where what services are under that umbrella.
So the BIA, they have programs such as police services, a lot of the environmental, like water rights. They do the higher education, Head Start, Indian Child Welfare, social services, basically almost everything that the Indian Health Service doesn't do. So anything that deals with health will be IHS, but all the other stuff when it goes to government, like I said, environmental, yeah, Road maintenance, it's a big umbrella.
So federal funding for Native American tribes is an issue that goes beyond government shutdowns. And in December of last year, the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights put out a report about federal funding shortfalls for tribes. How can you tell us about this issue with funding in general?
Oh, absolutely. So we'll take the BIA, for example. The programs and services that we receive, or that we're responsible for through our self-governance compact, are supposed to be funded through tribal shares from the BIA. We receive about, I don't even know if it's 20% of the total cost to operate these programs, which means that 80% or more is relying on the tribe or other alternative methods to pay for those programs. And it's funny that people want to talk about the shutdown right now and how much a big crisis it is, but tribes have been operating under crisis mode for so long because they've been underfunded. Even the Government Accountability Office came out with a report last month that identified several key differences in terms of design and structure and funding and population served between Indian Health Service and other federal health programs like the Veterans Health Administration, Medicare, and Medicaid. And as you said, the report from the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, they had a report that Congress asked them to do back in 2003, which showed how underfunded federal or Indian tribes are. Then they updated the report that was just published last month, and it says that there's still a lack of funding, that although there has been some progress, the federal government continues to fail to adequately support the social and economic well-being of Native Americans, and that Native Americans have still ranked near the bottom of all Americans in health, education, and employment outcomes.
And so that right there would be a tangible effect of this continual funding shortfall is in the area of outcomes.
Right, absolutely.
So where do you go from here? What are activists doing to push for change on this issue?
Well, right now I'm encouraging all the programs that I oversee to let me know what the impacts are of this shutdown. And what we're doing on the national level is we're going to try to advocate Congress to change the way that funding is received. Right now, IHS and the BIA are discretionary. They're funded through the discretionary category. We want to push that to mandatory funding. That way, if it's mandatory, we wouldn't be affected by future shutdowns. Another option is to have advanced appropriations. The Veterans Administration gets advanced appropriations, so that means that we would receive that funding before any other shutdown would occur. Medicaid is mandatory and it's not discretionary, so we're just asking that we be treated the same as other federal health programs and other programs throughout the federal government.
And only 20% of funding is coming from the government. Is that right?
On the BIA side.
Uh-huh.
So on the BIA side, we receive about 20. IHS side, we receive about 44%.
So what can be done, then, to prevent funding for tribes from falling short when there are these government shutdowns in the future? Is there any movement to be treated like other agencies?
Yes. We are passing some support letters. I just wrote up some support letters yesterday, actually, for our business committee to consider. So we'll be sending that to our local representatives in D.C. I know that the National Indian Health Board, the National Congress of American Indians, and other tribal organizations are working on changing the way that Indian programs are funded. A good way of doing that is to identify impacts in these stories that we have during the shutdowns now, to use that to our advantage to try to change Congress's way of thinking and how they're appropriating funds, and hopefully in the future it'll prevent, you know,
yeah,
situations.
Well, Candace, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Candace Skinnador is the self-governance coordinator for the Oneida Nation. We've been looking at how the partial government shutdown is impacting Native communities. The government shutdown, by the way, now in its 24th day, longest in U.S. history. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us on The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.